Hello and welcome to episode 54 of Speaking from Water. I'm your host, Sean Duncan. Today we have a very special guest. She comes at us from the great country of Australia. However, she's not Australian. She is American. And she is the captain of the USA women's life-saving team. She's also a designer and a lifeguard. April O'Gorman, thank you so much for having us. Or excuse me, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Sean.
So it's morning where you are. I'm just getting off the stand myself. It was a hot one. You're in Australia. You're going into the springtime, but you're also going into Worlds here in a few weeks.
Actually 1 week.
1 week. Next week. Well, how's the training been going and where are you?
It's good. So I'm on the Gold Coast training with Northcliffe Surf Life Saving Club, which is just 2 kilometers north of Kurrawa, which is where Worlds is going to be held. It's looking like weather's warming up. It was really cold the past month, but it's starting to warm up a little bit. They were calling for some really gross conditions and were thinking that they were going to have to move the event. And those conditions kind of went away and we're back to looking like some good weather, good conditions. So yeah, things are looking good for next week.
Well, I've seen videos of the past. I can't imagine they're going to not run it in all in conditions. Yeah. What are you looking at? What's the current forecast?
Yeah, current forecast for like the weekend where we're at the beach is like only 1 to 3 foot, a little bit bigger on Saturday, drops a little bit on Sunday, some windy chop. So not necessarily super clean, but it makes it more interesting and fun. And, you know, it's more about what the sport is. And so, yeah, it's good. We're going to have to move it. Like they were originally calling for like 14 foot 2 weeks ago. So even for like Australians, it really would have maybe only been Australia and New Zealand making it out in that. And everybody, all the other countries would have been really struggling.
Lots of broken skis.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So you were training today. What were you getting into today?
Mornings are swim and either weights or running. So this morning was weights. And we do those like together, the Northcliffe Girl Squad. Swimming is kind of like everyone has their own individual club that they go to. And then this afternoon is board and running.
Sick. So I want to get into your history, but first you're training with Northcliffe. A lot of people who might be listening don't know the intricacies of the life-saving world, but Northcliffe is one of the best competitive beaches in the world in Australia. You're training with them. What's the biggest like cultural takeaway you're receiving?
Yeah, I mean, I love training with Northcliffe. Like Naomi Flood, who is the girls coach there, is just amazing. And we have such a diverse group of girls. It's about 30 of us in total. And they have everyone from Lana Rogers, who is like the current series champion, Australian Ironwoman champion, Georgia Miller, who is arguably the best female Ironwoman of all time. And then you have girls who are just like trying to lose weight for their formal. So it's nice to have such a wide variety of girls, but all girls that are like willing to put in the work and keep showing up every single day. And I like Floody, I think it was about a month ago. It was rainy, horrible, cold conditions on a Saturday morning for irons. Just miserable. And it was, we knew we had like a 2.5 hour session ahead of us. It's dark still. It's like 5:30 in the morning. And I would say like the biggest cultural difference is that you are all showing up and doing it even in that versus the US. I feel like we have to be begging people to come and train with us, even if it's like the best conditions and so nice outside. You're like, please come, trying to work around their schedule. And here it's like, no, be there and you're not going to be late. Otherwise, don't come back.
Yeah. And speak to that, just the importance of surf life saving sport in Australia. They don't have many college athletes as far as traditional
what Americans believe, basketball, softball, volleyball, they don't have those sports. You know, life-saving is the sport. And can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy just how their athletics is set up compared to the US. Like you said, we have college sports, which is great because it helps you pay for school. It helped me pay for school. I swam in college. And that's really nice. But I think that it also can, you have ulterior motives for why you're doing your sport. So it's not necessarily like why you love your sport. It's like, no, this is my job. This is like paying for my school and for my future. Versus here, they don't have any of that. Like, you're not going to school based on your athletic abilities, and that's not helping you pay for it. So if you're doing your sport, it's because you want to be doing it and because you enjoy it. And I would say, like, the biggest difference I see is that people do sport longer because of it. So they're doing it past the traditional 22-year mark that kind of exists in the US. Is like so many college athletes in the US, they finish that senior year and they're like, I never want to do it again. Like, their mentality. Versus here, people will be doing it like well into their late 20s, early 30s, because they truly enjoy it, and that's why they keep doing it every single day. So yeah, I would say that's definitely a huge thing. And like, the culture of surf life saving in general in Australia is like 90% of their population lives on the coast. So their entire community is so water-based. For us to even be able to compete, we have to volunteer a certain amount of hours every single month. And that's how they lifeguard their beaches, which again is like crazy to me. I'm like, we can't even get people to show up to be lifeguards and we're paying them. I'm like, I can't even like imagine trying to, yeah, get people to do the sport in the US. And also, like, you need to lifeguard and we're not going to pay you for it. You need a volunteer. It's just like such a wild, different community cultural aspect of it. But yeah, I think it keeps it really close to, what the sport actually came from as well. And you have to still do it every single month.
Yeah, that struck me the most when I visited Australia was each little beach. They could be separated by maybe a mile, but they have a different young children's nipper squad. Another they compete against each other. It seems like everyone is involved in this sport. It's real beautiful. And here
From
in
like
America,
a young age.
yeah, super young age, and we have, five times the population. But when we try to compete on a world level against the Australians, it's kind of difficult.
But yeah, they're just doing it from like when they're like six. And then for us, it's like the age of this sport is typically after that college, like after you've done your college sport, because usually you can't do it. While you're also in college. I was just very lucky that I was able to, but it's very far and few between that of people who can do both at the same time. So then you're 22 when you're starting surf life saving, and it's a lot of skill and time in the water and time in the ocean. So yeah, we're already so behind when we line up against these Aussies who have been doing it like their entire lives.
Well, you're an inspiration for so many lifeguards here in America that want to live that endless summer, want to keep living the dream. You have fulfilled your dreams. You made a goal. You're there. You're doing it. Congratulations. And in
Thanks.
this podcast today, I want to kind of get into it as to how you did it, so others can follow in your footsteps. With all that said, though, like how does it feel to be there training with the best after the road you've paved?
Yeah, I mean, it's really weird looking back on it. Like, my senior year in high school, when I was like, I would say I really got hooked in this sport. I'm watching all of like the YouTube videos of Nutrigrain, Ironwoman, and Summer of Surf, all the videos is like really how I was learning, because there's not a whole lot of resources in the US for you to learn that kind of stuff. So I was really learning by like watching those videos. And so it's so crazy to me to like people that I was watching race in those videos that now it's like I'm training with on a daily basis is, yeah, kind of surreal.
That's wild. That's so wild. So you're from Florida. Paint us the picture. What was it like growing up there? Well, I believe you're originally from Hawaii and then moved to Florida. Tell us about your early days around the water and your impressions.
My dad was born and raised in Hawaii. I was born there, but we moved to Florida when I was pretty young. And Florida was like the next best opportunity for my dad, where it still felt a little bit like home, but wasn't as expensive and you had availability to the rest of the mainland. So I grew up in Florida as a swimmer. My dad was an ocean person, but growing up as a swimmer, I honestly didn't like the sand too much. I liked the ocean. I would like to go get wet, but then like that was it. I just wanted to leave right after. I hated like being gross and salty and sandy, that feeling. And then it was just always kind of a thing in our club swim team that once you turned 16, you became a beach lifeguard. So when that happened, I basically like totally embraced the salt, sandy, gross feeling after that. I used to have like a little pile of sand out by my feet in my car. I just always lived there, like totally did a 180. And I thought swimming was like the best thing ever, like so much fun, until I really started doing like open water swimming and paddling and this other stuff that I was like, wow, swimming in a pool is really boring actually. Because I just loved how different every single time the ocean was. It was never the same. So it made it interesting every single time. And especially being, I think, like a distance swimmer, it really appealed to me because I was just like so over the amount of hours and miles I had done in a pool where it was the same every single time.
And tell us about your first visit to the tryout and what that was like for you as a young person stepping out there and competing for the very first time. Because I think everyone's tryout is kind of their first introduction into the sport that is surf lifesaving. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think even growing up as a swimmer versus then transitioning to being a lifeguard is such an interesting mental shift as well, because you are used to a controlled environment and you are used to, you go to a swim meet and you know exactly almost to the minute of when you are doing your race, if they're like following it on in time. You know, you have your heat sheet, you know what heat you are, what lane you are, and you know all of that. And I remember like, and it's funny because it was like the tryout, so USLA standards for things, we had to do like a 50 free, right, in a pool. And I remember it was me and all these other swimmers, and they were just going to have us get up on the block and do our 50 free. And we were all like, we don't get to warm up. We don't get to, like, and they were like, do you get to warm up for a rescue? And I was like, fair enough. Like, it wasn't like we needed to be worried about hitting the time. It was just so foreign to us that it was just like, oh, get up and dive in and swim a 50 as fast as you can. But like when you're going on a rescue, yeah, that's how you're doing it. There's no warm up. You're just going in for it. So that, I think that was like the first like sort of shock for me, like that mental switch of having to go from being like a swimmer to a lifeguard. And then, I mean, every competition after that is kind of the same. Like, I don't know if I've ever been to a surf life saving competition where it went exactly in the order that they said it was going to go in, just because of conditions and, you know, stuff happens and it's ocean and it's unpredictable. So yeah, that things end up getting switched around and you don't know exactly like when you're going and when you're being marshaled and put on the line for things, which again is like so similar to the actual profession that it came from. So that first like tryout then that was in the ocean, I think I also just like took for granted how comfortable I was in the ocean because of my dad, because of just our family and growing up in the place that I did. I was totally comfortable going and swimming a 500 out in the ocean and thought that it was really fun. And for a lot of people, like that was the hardest part for them. And I'd say probably it was not the hardest part for me. It was the other stuff of like, the medical side of it, that would definitely be harder for me. So yeah, I felt very lucky that I was as comfortable in the ocean, and really like put into perspective for me how other people aren't and don't have that availability and didn't grow up with that. And yeah, just felt very thankful.
What beach was this in Florida?
Daytona Beach is like where, so I was a lifeguard for Volusia County for 7 years, through high school and college and a little bit after college. And Daytona Beach in Volusia County is like where our main headquarters are, but I spent most of my time actually lifeguarding in New Smyrna, which is like the southern end of the county.
Sick. Yeah, they have really good surfing there. You surf?
Yeah. Love to. Yeah, really good surfing in New Smyrna and a lot of sharkies, but they're little guys.
They're out there, right? Yeah. So what's the lifeguarding culture there like down there in the Daytona Beach area? I mean, I've been to Jack's Beach. That has its deep, you know, 100 plus year history. Is it the same in Daytona Beach area?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I'm very excited to say that it's like, it's growing again. They kind of had a lull for like 15 years ish, but back in the day, they were actually like on par with LA County, like getting their flights paid for to go out and race at nationals, and were like up there racing for national championships against those guys. Had many of them on the national team. Tom McGivney, who is our manager for the US national team this Worlds, he is an officer in Volusia County, and he's actually our most decorated American for Worlds medals. He's been on the team before. His wife was on the team in the past as well. So yeah, definitely a deep history there, and it kind of like had a lull for a little bit, and we're building it back up with a lot of our U19 kids right now. So it's cool to see.
So you had your rookie year. Was that the same year you got into your first comp?
Yeah, I was really just timing of things, how it worked out that 2015 was when Nationals was in Daytona Beach. So it's very fortunate for me. I didn't have to like go very far. I just showed up at Nationals.
So you went straight to Nationals. You didn't do a regionals first to like feel the vibe?
I did, like, and I think regionals that year was in Flagler, I want to say, or St. Augustine, somewhere not far again, like only like 45 minutes north of us. And I was so just like in the mentality of I'm swimming in college that I only think I went to regionals and basically only did surf, swim, and like bun swim run. And I think that's it. And then because I had like senior champs or right after, like a couple days after. So I remember I just went up for like the one day, and then same at Nationals, just showed up for all the swim stuff. But I remember leaving that Nationals and wanting to do everything else. I was like, I'm gonna learn how to do all this other stuff, because it annoyed me so much only being able to swim, because I surfed and I did other things, and I was like, I feel like I can do this other stuff. So that winter between like my rookie year and my second year, I basically tried to teach myself how to paddle in like the winter East Coast conditions, which, if any of you know what that's like, it's just like a big washing machine. And I'm on like a 20-year-old force field that's like from 2000, is like almost as old as I am, and just getting like demolished all winter long. But then yeah, I like did my first paddle race the following summer, and one of the guards who had been around for a while basically like took pity on me and let me use his like better board that wasn't 20 years old. And that was the first time that I was like, I felt like, oh, I can actually like do this. And I remember my younger brother came to watch, and he was like, oh, I'm gonna film it for mom and dad. And I was like, no, don't film it, this is gonna be so bad. And then I actually like, I came in second behind Eva Porter, who was supposed to go to Worlds on the open team that summer. This is 2016 now, and I'm not even 18 at the time. I think I'm 17. And she was like, are you trying to make the U19 team that's going to Worlds? And this is how naive I am. Like, I don't even, you know what this is. I was like, oh, maybe next year. Like, I'm swimming in college, like, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, Worlds is only every 2 years. I was like, oh, okay. Like, just had no idea. But that was my first national team trip, was that year. I basically went out to California that summer for nationals and made that U19 team. And that was my first national team in Netherlands at Worlds in 2016.
Wow. You went straight to the top. And
I was hooked right away.
Yeah. And so then what was your trajectory? You were just like, I'm going to finish college. I'm going to do this kind of on the side. What was your thinking?
I went to that Worlds, that first one, and it was kind of the same sort of feeling that I had at that first nationals. I was there as a swimmer. I had like learned how to do the paddleboard and the ski stuff, but I had only been doing it for like 2 months. And so they just kept me as a swimmer. And I remember leaving that Worlds and I basically was like, I never want to be on another national team again as just a swimmer. I like am traveling all the way across the world and I want to do all these other things. And I remember standing there with my mom too, and we're in the stands at the pool on the last day of the competition and hearing the Australia national anthem for like the 50th time in that moment. And she was basically like, I think she also knew in that moment, like, oh, we're going to be doing this a while. She was like, you're not going to be done with this until like you're hearing the U.S. national anthem, are you? I was like, yeah, no, I don't think so. So basically after that, I, you know,
hey, can I, for I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Did you say a pool?
Yeah. So there's Worlds. You have 2 days in the pool and you have 2 days in the ocean, and the pool events are crazy. It's mostly like a European sport, but like in like Europe, they'll have pool swimming and then they have pool life saving. So you're using these huge like fiberglass fins that are like that big and super rigid. And you're doing like underwaters, like long course, 50 meters, and you're carrying a mannequin that's like full of water, that's like 70 pounds, and obstacles. They do like obstacles in the pool that's supposed to like mimic the waves. So the first 2 days of Worlds is like different relays and individual events of that stuff, which is so
at
wild.
At all Worlds. This is like part of Worlds.
This is okay. Part of Worlds.
Wow. Yeah. I did not know this.
Yeah,
it blows my mind.
Yeah, it's really crazy to watch if you look up some videos doing it.
Is it because they want to be more inclusive with the world, because everywhere doesn't have a beach, so it's not just like the Australian life-saving culture that we've kind of adopted here in America?
And it's definitely so the International Life-Saving Federation is the one who is in charge of basically is our governing body for our sport, and they are the ones that put on Worlds every 2 years. And so they do pool. They're in charge of like, they're the governing body of pool and of ocean. And they're all coming from, the profession of life-saving. So whether that's in a pool or an ocean. Like you said, Europe and some other places that just are way more pool focused with their life-saving than they are ocean focused. So Worlds is divided in that way. So they actually you have a winner of the pool days, you have a winner of the ocean, and then you have a winner of combined of like who is the best both overall. But it's pretty evenly weighted because of that and like number of events.
Do you compete in the pool events also?
Yeah. So I will be doing mannequin carry mannequin carry relay, which is like, it's crazy. It's only 100 meters. And so you have two of your competitors sitting in the middle of the pool and you're passing a mannequin. You have like a transition zone and it's just a really fast 100 with four people. So I'll be doing that. Those are like the more skill ones and less of like the swimming. Like the most like just swimming one is obstacles, because you're just like going under a gate basically, but it's a 200, so that's the most like swimming. And we have Montana White and Samantha Tatter, who are on this world's team, who are Olympic trial swimmers this past summer. So they'll be doing those more swimming ones, and I'll be doing more of like the skill pool ones, because I've been training over here with it as well. Like Northcliffe has trainings 2 times a week for pool rescue as well. So yeah, I'll be doing those. They also have the first day before the pool events that's called Cirque, and it's a scenario that you're judged on. So you have 4 people from your team. So like me and Tom O'Neill and Brian Murphy and Tim Berdiak, I think, are the ones that are going to do it this year for the US. They basically pull us behind. Like they take 4 people from every team, and you're like trapped behind this room for the whole day. And there's like an order of when the countries go, and you don't get to see the other countries go, but they basically give you a piece of paper of like what your scenario is going to be. And then you like run out onto the pool deck, and you're assessing and doing your rescue. It's 3 minutes. And they have judges, and they hire people to like act like they're fake drowning. There's dead bodies on the bottom of the pool. It's madness. So that's actually like the first day of Worlds, like the first event of Worlds is that Cirque one that takes like the entire day.
That's incredible. I did not know any of this.
Yeah.
So wild. Well, you know, you went right to it. You went right to the world. So that,
yeah, sorry.
that's how it goes. What was your next step though? Because you were there, then you had to come home. You're going to college. How did you view your priorities in life?
Yeah, I remember. I mean, before getting into this sport, I was so focused on just college swimming. Like I just needed swimming to help pay for my school, and that was my main concern. And then it kind of switched to I needed a school that was going to be okay, that I was going to be doing this over the summer, or be okay that I might have to leave for a week in the fall to go to Worlds, or the International Surf Challenge that's on the in-between year of Worlds. So when I started looking at schools, I would ask the coaches basically about it. I got, again, incredibly lucky, fortunate, that the school that I really wanted to go to, Savannah College of Art and Design, the head coach at the time, Bill Pilzak, he was on the US team for swimming, like in 1996, something like that, for 50 free. He was a sprinter, went to the Olympics for the US. But when he was training for that, he was actually living in Australia with 2 guys that were doing surf lifesaving at Currumbin and was swimming at the Miami Aquatic Center that's here on the Gold Coast. So not very many people in the US know what this sport is, but I got very lucky that my coach knew exactly what it was and understood that when I am going to train, I'm not going to just like float on my board and catch waves, that it's like, no, you're like actually doing a workout. So I was very lucky with that. And he basically would let me miss afternoon practices to go to the beach in Savannah, which is Tybee, which is not much of a beach. It's more of like a lake, but I would basically go there on my own in the afternoons and do paddle or do ski. And that's how I was kind of able to keep doing both while still swimming in college.
So it's pretty safe to say he was a life-changing influence on you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he knew that also I would probably like lose my mind if I wasn't able to do full. And so I think it was also just like, okay, we need to let April do this so that she keeps swimming for us as well. I definitely like needed that break. It helped me like so much on the swimming side as well. Like some of my fastest times are still from like those first couple of years that I started surf lifesaving, and I would go from like regionals next day, senior champs doing an 800 meter. And like those races, I was able, for some reason, they just helped my swimming like so much. I think just adversity of training instead of just like, again, always doing the same exact thing, just different kind of training, really was helpful to me. So I think that he also understood that part of me too, that I was just like, I need this adversity in my training, and my swimming's going to be better because of it. So you want me to do it.
And what year did you graduate college?
You're testing me. What year did I? 2022.
Okay, so you've been out for a couple years now, and you did go into the workforce out of college.
Yeah.
I believe you worked for Pepsi.
Yeah.
In New York.
Yeah, so I went to the Savannah College of Art and Design for industrial design and sustainability. Graduated COVID. And then got hired by PepsiCo, so the governing body of Pepsi, or like the parent company of Pepsi. They also own like Gatorade. I was more on the snack side, so that was like Lay's, Cheetos, Doritos, all of that good stuff. And I was PepsiCo Global, working in their design innovation department, working as a design strategist. So I was basically focused more on like helping their snack side reach their sustainability goals while still making money. So how are they going to keep making snacks that they already make today, but in a better way in like 10 years? So that was my job for 2022 until basically I came here to Australia. And now I just work as a contractor, basically doing the same kind of thing for people. So design strategy work, sustainable growth.
Well, here's my question, because so many people, they can, you had this awesome dream, and with Surf Life Saving, you get out of college and you get what looks like just a dream job, really. You're working for a big company, you're fresh out of college. Like, were you fulfilled there, or were you just like, something's not right here, I need to make a change? And to those listening that can relate, that are young, what were kind of the things going on in your head that got you to make this big move?
Yeah, I mean, it was a dream job, like, especially for what I wanted to do post-SCAD. That was such a dream job. I thought that I wanted to live in New York, like, before I found this sport. Like, when I was looking at colleges, I was looking at like NYU. So I really thought, like, at some point in my life, I thought that I was going to live and work in New York. So for that to be my first job out of college was like so insane. And New York is an awesome place. Like, it's a great city, but if you're trying to do surf life saving and live in New York City, it's a little difficult. I was like paddling in the Hudson. Like, I was doing crazy things to try to keep doing both of these lives at the same time. Tom O'Neill and a lot of the guys that are on this national team, they train out at Reese Park, which is like one of the closest beaches you can get to from Manhattan. But it was still like a 2-hour journey, public transport, for me to get there from like me like living in Manhattan. So for me to go do an iron session with Tom O'Neill on a Saturday morning, like, it was like 4 hours of just traveling to get there and back. And like, now add New York winter to that, and you're carrying a soaking wet wetsuit and boots and hood and gloves with that as well. It was a test for sure. And you know, I wouldn't change those experiences. Like, I loved being in New York for the time that I was, but basically I couldn't do both. It felt like I had balanced both the best of my abilities for as long as I could, and it was kind of coming to a tipping point of like, I either need to go all in as New York designer, or I need to make a change, because my past like 6 years of doing this, what was really carrying me through that like 2 years of New York. And I was like, I need to step up my training again. Otherwise, like, I could just feel it was like at this tipping point. It was crazy. I was literally flying back and forth from New York to Florida every single week, because it was cheaper than living in New York full time, and because I would prefer to at least spend half the week like in the warmer, you know, where I could train, but it would just be like my training would go through this like week of peak of training and then like go off in New York and like be able, you know, just doing what I could, like running and swimming and weights and whatever, but and like maybe doing some sort of craft like on the weekends, and then like peak again for a week. And then so it was just not like a sustainable way of like training for a long time. So yeah, did it as long as I could, but now I'm here.
So where did you sleep then when you were in New York? Did you have like a hotel or an apartment?
So like the first couple of months, because I didn't have a place yet, a permanent place, I was like Airbnb-ing it. And I kind of like found a couple that I really liked, and I would book them so far out and like my flights like so far out that it would just work out. And then once I was there and I had, you know, friends and somewhat of a community there, I also just got really fortunate with like people knowing my situation, knowing that they have a roommate, but like only for really half the month. So really giving me deals on, you know, where I was living and would rent out like a room to me in their place for like half that amount of time. So yeah, I just got really lucky with people.
Do you remember the moment when you said, I'm done doing this?
I don't know if it was like a moment. It was such a hard decision. It was one of the hardest decisions of my life, choosing to leave PepsiCo because it was a dream job, to follow a different dream, was an incredibly scary moment. And especially to that chase another dream that was across the world, and away from everything that you knew. So, I mean, I remember the moment that I had to tell PepsiCo, which was a really scary moment. But it was, I would say it was more of a slow burn. It was more of a slow burn of like me asking myself, like, how much longer can you do this kind of a thing? And like, is this really what you want? And like, what makes you happy? And I loved the work. I loved the PepsiCo work, but I didn't love New York. I was much happier in the sun and the warmth, and that was where I ultimately felt the happiest. And so that was kind of like what helped make my decision, was like, I need to be in an environment where I am happy all the time, regardless of, you know, I think it's more about your environment than like the work. You can find work that you love anywhere. I enjoy what I'm doing now, like, for work wise, but like, I also am in the sun and, doing this other part that really fulfills me as well.
Did you line up your Australia situation before you told PepsiCo that you're leaving?
I mean, I definitely planned, like I had to plan for like 9 months before it was like I was coming here, of just like saving to like be able to come here. Like I had to like plan that out for so long, and like for, you know, what my New York expenses were, and like knowing like, okay, this is when I get my yearly bonus. I need to wait until after that, and like then maxing out like how much I could save by just like being home for the month before, and like being able to spend time with family before then coming here. So I mean, I floody, like, because I was in Australia in 2016 for like 4 months training with Northcliffe as well. So has been asking me for years, like, when are you coming back? When are you coming back?
You go to Australia in 2016, you establish your contacts.
Yeah.
You then, and who is this you're speaking of?
My coach at Northcliffe. I should explain that, I guess. So those like YouTube videos and stuff I was learning from, when I got to Savannah College of Art and Design, I was actually originally there for film and television. So my freshman year, I thought I was going to like you know, have to wait 4 years before I could do Circ lifesaving again. It was like, this was before my coach kind of like made this situation with me. And I was really bummed about having to like wait that amount of time. And so I basically, I got a internship with the company that does all the filming that of those YouTube videos that I was watching for Fox Sports Australia for all of the surf life saving stuff. So I came over after like my last quarter of SCAD, my freshman year, I spent in Australia leading into our summer. So it was like March to July. I was filming and was with Northcliffe training and was a little 18-year-old and had no idea what I was doing. I thought that like, oh, I know how to surf ski. And then I get to Northcliffe and Floody, our girls coach, was like, what the heck are you doing? And like had to like completely retrain me how to do everything. Like I was just a little 18-year-old that just so badly wanted to learn and soaked up as much as I could because there was just nobody in the US for me to learn from. So I went over there and did that for 4 months.
So that really got you the culture that gave you the identity of what this thing is and set the seed.
It definitely planted the seed of like, okay, I'm doing this. Like that was like a dream of mine for so long. And the fact that it was like, I was able to go over and do that so much sooner than I thought I was going to be able to. And then, I went basically that summer. Then I came back to the US and that was when I won Iron Woman that summer. And I was 18. And so like the amount of like, yeah.
In the nation.
Yeah.
At nationals.
Yeah. 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 Thanks. Yeah. So that was, it gave me so much confidence. Obviously I learned so much in it. I loved it. And then from there on, it was like, okay, like I'm going to go back to Australia. It was just a matter of when. And then had 3 more years of college, COVID, had to save money, had to get a job. So yeah, from like that 2018 to now being here in 2024, it took 6 years. And that's what like Floody, my coach, like, when are you coming back? Like, and so, yeah, it took a long time of a lot of planning to like make it back here finally. But yeah, we made it.
So did you hit those other nationals along the way after you won? And how did those go?
So that 2018 was the only iron that I've won. I've had different national titles in between there, like board, I think was 2021. We were off in 2020 because of COVID. 2022, I've had a lot of second places of iron behind Kelsey between now and then, and surf ski, a lot of second places behind Kelsey. Board rescue with Hallie a couple times. Rescue race with Hallie Linsky a couple times. So yeah, I've had other ones in between there, but haven't gotten iron of them.
And what's Kelsey's last name?
Cummings. So she's also on this team for Worlds. Basically, I would say the top 5 iron women in the US at some point have come to Australia and trained. Kelsey has, Holly Main, who's also on this team, has Hallie Linsky, who has been on many teams in the past. She has as well. Like there was a time, I think it was that 2018 Worlds, that year that I won, there was 5 US national team members in Australia at the same time, all training at different surf clubs for like whatever their focus was. So yeah, it's definitely definitely a lot of people come here to get better.
How long have you now been in Australia doing your training?
I just passed 3 months. No, yeah. May, June, July. Yeah. 3 months.
So you headed out in it's winter time. You're headed into the main season, and
yeah,
and you know, you've had all these years of winning, training. How does it all stack up right now? You've really focused these last 3 months. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. Like, I have never done the inner clubs, which is, so like Worlds, they'll do Masters for a week, which is actually this week going on right now. Then they do it all again for the countries. And then they do it all again for inner clubs. And your inner clubs, you can just sign up as your club team. Like, you just race as you would be Wrightsville. You could just go as Wrightsville and compete at Worlds. So that second week, so next week for me is Team USA. And that is like so much more of, you know, team basis. Like, you are doing what is best for the team in that. And that's so much fun. But that next week is more about just like you and like what you want to race and what you want to put into it, kind of thing. I have never been able to do that second week because of college and, you know, have to get back to school and swimming and stuff. So I'm really excited for that second week, to be able to do whatever races I want. And, you know, then this is like my first time competing, since last summer. And then we have trials for the series in November. So I've never been able to do an Australia full on season. I've done their nationals before, their Aussies, but I've never been able to like do all the races, that lead up to Aussies. So I'm super excited to be like training with Northcliffe and all of these girls, and then be able to have a team to go race with at these different competitions for their summer, or your winter.
And you speak of the series. We're talking about the Nutrigrain Iron Woman Iron Man series, right?
Yeah. Which has actually just been renamed this season to the Shawn Partners Iron Series. They got a new title sponsor for that. But yeah, exciting. It's very different because of this new title sponsor. They're taking 24 women, 24 men. I think the only 12 automatically qualify from last year. So trials in November will basically be looking for 12 athletes, which out of how many athletes there are in Australia that like want this, is going to be an insane weekend. Boiling down to those 12 people is going to be pretty wild.
Well, let's first talk about how big of a deal this is in Australia. If anyone Googles it or YouTubes it, just the coverage alone is like watching, say, the NFL or the pro baseball in America, NBA. The camera angles, the announcers, it's on national TV. It's a humongous deal. First of all, congratulations, even contemplating being in it. And how do you feel about where you're going to land?
I mean, no U.S. woman has ever made it. We'll just start there. In the history of it, only one U.S. guy has ever made it in, and that was Craig Hummer in the 90s. So yeah, it's obviously incredibly hard for all the things that we've previously said. Like, they've been doing this their entire lives, and we're jumping into this very late in the game. Like, I am relatively old at Northcliffe training with these girls. Like, most of the girls are a lot younger than I am. But I am really excited about it. Like, I hope that it happens this year, but I am also like very okay putting in my time and seeing if that happens next year. Yeah, we're just going to see how it goes. Iron races are unpredictable. This entire sport is unpredictable. You catch a wave and you're in it suddenly. So yeah, we'll see.
Well, that really is the beauty of the sport. And for those listening who don't understand what we're talking about, the Iron is a event that it's not always set in this order, but it's a swimming, it's a board race, it's a paddle race on a surf ski with a run in between each of those. And you just nailed the head on that. the ocean can make someone win or lose. If you watch any of these races, the race can change on a dime if someone catches a wave out the back, or if they get wrecked at the start on their ski. Yeah. There's so many variables. Speak to the variables and speak to what you do love so much about this race.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely the longer the race is, because my background is in distance, it's like the better that I tend to do. So iron for me has always been one of my better ones, just because people start to get tired on that third leg and I can hang on that third leg. I love that the order changes every single time, because you have to be training for so many different situations, because you get to race day and you don't know what it's going to be. And then you have the surf, like you said, that is always different every single time you do it, and depending on like where it's the course is as well. And even your lane, like you draw a lane and you could be on the north end of like 24 girls stacked up on this line, and there's a rip on your side and you're just getting shot straight out, versus like the people on the southern side might have like a huge bank that, you know, of shore pound that they have to get through. So there's so many different variables. And then you add the 20 other women that you're doing it with, and are they going to lose their ski and it's going to run into you? Like, you know, you have so many other things going on, which like, I think is like what I really enjoy about it. Like you, the mental part of having, you are thinking the entire time, you know, like how you're going to come up to this buoy and angle it so that you're going to catch this next runner and go around somebody, and like you're on their draft, and then I'm going to go around the buoy and pass them because I was just saving energy being on their draft. So I think for like my overactive mind as well, it's very satisfying to be able to like have a race where it requires like so much thought as well at the same time. Like it's not, it already is so physically demanding, and then you add in the mental part of it, and it's just, yeah, it's a beast.
So sick how you describe it. Take us to the starting line. You've been on a lot of starting lines. What's your feeling like at the starting line, and what do you have? Do you have a mental preparation? Where does your head go? How stoked are you? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I actually usually get pretty quiet before races. And that's usually just because I am a huge mental person. Like I'm running through that race in my head like many, 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 many times before that race is happening. So when I'm going up to the starting line, like I'm doing the race in my head, like we're already doing it. And so like, just like what I was saying before is like, it's such a mental strategy game to it. And knowing who you're around as well. Like I know the girl next to me is a really good runner. She's going to have a really good start. So maybe I'm going to tuck in behind her and just follow her out. And then I know when she starts swimming, she's going to die. So then I need to like go around her. So all of those kind of things is like really what's going through my head when I'm really quiet walking into a starting line, is like making my strategy or my plan for like how this race is going to go. Yeah. Yeah.
And then when you get into your race, there is a silence sometimes when you're out there. What goes on in your head then? Like, are you still analyzing where you are in the pack? Say you're at the front of the pack, are you just trying to steamboat ahead?
What are some experiences? I think that most of what's going through my head when it's the race is actually happening is a lot of Floody, like our coach's words from Northcliffe. Like she always is drilling into us, it's about no mistakes. It's not necessarily about like how fast you are, it's just like trying to make the least amount of mistakes as possible. So like doing everything as perfectly as I can is like usually what's going through my head, of just like picking up the board, like very in the moment of like what I am doing right now, and not necessarily like looking at where the rest of the pack is, where the other girls are, like just what am I doing right now so that you're not making mistakes. And also what's going through my head is something she told me in 2018 that has lived with me forever. is that an iron hurts for everybody, for every single person doing it. You are all in pain. But, you know, it's about how much you are willing to hurt, and it's temporary pain. And letting somebody beat you that you know maybe shouldn't is a kind of pain that lasts a lot longer. So get through the temporary pain. Like, we're all dealing with this, just temporary, so just do it.
So sick. What's the breathing like for you? Do you save up ever, or are you just like, you know yourself so well that you, there's a certain way you lay it out?
I mean, I love the sort of, Wim Hof, I'm going to say his name wrong.
Yeah, you're good.
Like where it's, yeah, where you're like, taking a lot in before the race almost. And then just reminding yourself, like, deep breathing to not get into that like hyperventilation sort of state. And I think like a main difference here then versus in the US is that like run transition, people tend to like use that as almost like a recovery. And it's like, no, that's when you go, like, that's when you're like passing people or catching people. And it's almost like falling back on what you're comfortable in. And like, I am comfortable in a surf ski. I am comfortable on a board. I am comfortable swimming. So that's when it's like, you're getting your breath back almost in that of like your deep breathing, like,
yeah.
But get through the transitions as quickly as possible, because that's just like when you're going to make up time.
Well said. So what are the world races indications to the Nutrigrain series, or is there a separate qualification for those?
There's a separate qualification for those. So because it's still early in Australia season, like they're just coming out of winter. So a lot of the girls who aren't racing at Worlds have been doing our sort of like sprinty stuff already to like help us get ready for it. But that's kind of like not characteristic of the kind of training that they do this time of year. They have like their longest race in October, which is Coolangatta Gold. And it's like a 3-hour race somewhere around there, like 54 kilometers, I think, something like that in total of ski, board, swimming, running, of all of it. So they are usually way more distance this time of year. So after Worlds, we'll like jack the distance back up for October and then drop it right after, because then it's like they'll have trials, I think are usually like second week of November-ish. And that's when that weekend, it's one weekend that of just like heats, quarters, semis, finals, of like finding out who that top 12 females and males are that then get added to the series. And then the series is spread across a couple of weeks throughout their season. And they have other races for people who don't make the series that go throughout the entire season as well. But yeah, so everything kind of starts in November for them. For us, I guess.
Maybe. Yeah. 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 So you're a captain on the US team. What does the job of a USA captain entail?
Oh, I mean, not too much, just organizing. It's just a lot of, I mean, because it's a volunteer organization. USLA is all volunteer based. And because this is my 7th team trip. So I've been on a lot of Worlds trips. I've been on a lot of teams. And so I just, you know, when it's a new coach every couple of years, they're still figuring it out. And I'm just a helpful resource to be able to say like, okay, well, this is what we've done in the past. Like, this is what worked. This is what didn't, and can give my opinion on certain situations. So that's most of what I would say like a captain, sort of entails. And yeah. And especially it's pretty helpful with me already being here, is that I can kind of like give them the rundown on different things of like, okay, this hotel is better than that one. This is what time our pool training is leading up to it. So a lot more like organization, managing stuff, helping them fundraise for the last couple of months, so that we don't have to pay as much to do it, because it is expensive to like send the coaches and stuff over here and rent gear and hotels and all of it. So yeah, helping fundraise and different things.
Awesome. So what makes a coach a great coach in your perspective?
Floody is what I would consider a great coach to be, and she's always there. Like, anything you need, you have a question, you need a workout, she's there. Like, no matter what, you just text her. I would say like that is what a great coach is. It's just like always being there. You know, it's weird. Like, I have had to be coach in the US these past couple of years. And I would say like a lot of the things that I love about Floody, like, are things that I have tried to do in the US as well. Just like being there, like, if you need a workout, just text me, like, I'll do it. I'll try to like help you find craft or gear if you need it. Like, you just have to ask. And I think that like people are sometimes like scared to ask, and especially like somebody like Floody, because she's just like such a badass, but like she's not scary. Like, she's there to help, and for the same reasons she's doing it is because she was an athlete at one point, and she knows that, yeah, you just need somebody sometimes. Like, she's just trying to be the coach that she wished she had too.
Nice. And you, in addition to all your roles, you also manage the USA life-saving sport page on Instagram. That's how we got connected originally. Speak to that page and what your goals are with it in regards to the culture of surf life-saving sport.
Yeah. So, I mean, being an athlete on so many team trips and spending a ridiculous amount of money on this life, I don't love that part of it. Like, I think that it should be that if you are on Team USA, like, you shouldn't be having to pay that stuff. Like, it should be congratulations, please come race for us. And I think that that also restrains a lot of people from even being able to like go to nationals or regionals, which is really sad to me. Like, I feel incredibly privileged that I, you know, haven't needed to necessarily like not go to a competition because of something like that. But I'm also working a lot to make sure that I can go to those and do those things, and spending a lot of my own money so that I can do those things. But I know that a lot of lifeguards are not even paid enough for a livable wage. And then you're asking them to go run around and do these competitions and pay a lot of money is a hard ask. So I wanted to try to help us fundraise more and get sponsors, but I knew from just working at PepsiCo, like, we had absolutely zero online presence. Like, we did not have a whole lot to offer these businesses. So the main goal of that Instagram of US Life-Saving Sport is to just highlight that our sport is awesome and that there's really cool people doing it in the US, and really just to like help spread the word of that and connect us all together. Like, there was so much separate things happening around the US that they didn't know that they were doing that, and West Coast didn't know that this was happening over here in New Jersey. And like, there's just so much going on that people just didn't realize because there was no like central thing connecting it. So really it was just to, yeah, bring us all together and show how awesome and great the sport is, to bring in more people into the sport, like the college swimmers that don't know it exists. And then as we grow, hopefully we can attract some bigger sponsors that will make it easier for us to put on different events, for us to send our athletes to different events, and so that it's just less financial burden on our national team.
And if you had to describe this culture and what it is to say someone who has no idea what we're talking about, what would you say?
I think it's just such a cool group of people that come from such a humble place of wanting to help others, and stay in shape and like be healthy. And we all have that in common. And then we're also just all a little competitive. We then want to race each other and see how we go against each other. But like a lot of good like qualities that are all sort of bringing us together of just like, yeah, caring, competitive, wanting to stay healthy. And yeah, it's a good group of people.
So well said, April. I can just relate so much with my own squad here in Wrightsville Beach. Shouts out Wrightsville Beach Ocean Rescue. And I've been with them since 2011. And I've done the competitions every year. I haven't guarded since 2013, except for this year. I was like, you know what? We're going to come back. We're going to do the job. We're going to sit in the stand at least a few days. And it turned out like I've been sitting at least 4 to 5 days a week. And it's just like, I forgot what it was like to do the thing. And I'd like to bring it home to you. You've done the thing, you've sat the stand, you've done the job. What's that like? What's that like to you? Explain that to the people, what being a lifeguard is all about and yeah. What it's like to save somebody from a death situation and then have them like, thank you, you just saved their life. Then you're just like, you're welcome. You're boom, you're back in the stand. Maybe you do it 5 more times in that day. Talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel incredibly thankful that I had those experiences at such a young age. Like I would say like most of my gnarliest rescues were like, I was like under 18. It's like 17 years old. And it was so cool to be able to use something like the amount of years at that point I had been swimming competitively for 9 years to be able to use so many hours of my life that I had spent training to be able to save someone's life. Like that was so crazy to me. Like I had only ever used swimming before that as just swimming fast, of just going faster times. And in that moment, that saved someone's life. And that was, yeah, such a crazy thing for me. And that's why this sport is so cool, because it's the same. Like you're training every single day, but then on the weekends, on Saturdays, you're sitting and, yeah, pulling people out of the ocean using those same exact skills. Like I actually, that just reminded me, in like 2021, we're at Nationals in South Padre, Texas. And South Padre, I don't know, I'm sure like other surf life saving people at Nationals, similar things have happened where we are at Nationals and you are saving people still, like bystanders that are like floating into the course, and you end up like, wow, for you getting pulled into a rip, you don't realize that how fortunate that you just did that in front of the national life saving championships. But I remember like after we had finished Nationals in South Padre, me and Hallie Linsky had just won board rescue. And I had also won board that year. And we're going to walk down to take pictures. And it's like me, Hallie Linsky, Casey Francis, and we're taking like Team Florida photo. And as we're like walking down to the water, we just see these three girls that are just like literally bobbing and like getting sucked out in this rip so fast. And all of us, we go, yep. Mm-hmm. Like we didn't even need to say anything to one another. It was just like, go. And like, so I turn around and I get a board and Casey's like already out there in the water with them. And then we like have them hang onto the board and we're paddling in. And Casey is hysterically laughing the entire time, because she's like, you guys are getting rescued by the national board rescue champion. She just thought that was like the funniest thing ever. But it's so true. Like it is really cool that we are able to use how we stay in shape every single day, but to also save people.
What a beautiful story. That's so awesome. So good. Before I let you go, when you're in water, what's your favorite water to be in? What does it look like when you dream of water? What is that water?
Yeah, I would say it's probably like So Ponce Inlet, which is a little bit south of Daytona. Ponce Inlet on like a clear day, like beautiful surf, offshore winds, maybe some rain, maybe some like liquid sunshine. Like it's still a little sunny, but it's sprinkling and just like making it super calm. I love being in the ocean when it's raining, and you know, just being under the water and like seeing it is like so cool to me. Yeah, I'd say that's probably my favorite water to be in.
Well done. So good. A few more questions. Are you reading any books at the moment?
Oh, I am, but it's really funny. Oh, I don't have it right here. It's called The Gold Coast, which is hilarious because I'm on the Gold Coast, but it's actually about South Florida. And it's just like this tiny book that I started, and I thought I would like literally finish it on my flight here. And I've just been so busy going that like I've managed to read like 5 pages once a week and somehow have not finished this like 130 page book. So that's what I'm still reading right now. Just goes around with me.
And like on that note, like, are all the Australians very intrigued by where you're from and what your beach is like in Florida? And like, are they inspired to go to America?
Some of them. It's also really funny because I think a lot of them assume that it's similar. And so like they don't realize like how good they have it or how different it is. Like, I mean, even when I was doing so like the bronze course, which is like their lifeguard like equivalent out here, is standardized across the entire like country, Australia. Like everyone knows the same things. And like even that, they're like, oh yeah, it's probably the same as yours, like in the US. And I'm like, no, it's not. Like like we have no standardization. Like every single beach does things differently, like for like what your codes are and like how you're whistling people in. And so I mean, yeah, it's I think a lot of them assume that it's really similar, and I'm like, no. And then once they find out how different it is, they're like, whoa. Like
yeah,
yeah, they don't realize.
That's awesome. So what aside from where you're going this season, do you see yourself in Australia for years? Is this you're locked in?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, obviously pending visas, work, all of that good stuff. But yeah, hopefully. I thought I was gonna, you know, be doing the endless summer and kind of like coming back and forth quite a bit, but now that I'm an alumni lifeguard, when it comes to the US, like I'm not sitting a stand every single summer, unfortunately. I don't see a reason for needing to come back for our summer. Like I'll come back probably for like July, August to like do regionals, nationals, say hi to everyone, see family, do all those kind of good things. But yeah, I just would go back to being coach and like being by myself really for most of the time. And it's really nice having a coach here and having 20 other girls to train with. So yeah, I probably will end up here a lot more than I thought I was.
What's your advice for the kids out there, the young champions listening? What do you have to tell them?
I would say just keep doing it. Like this sport takes so many years of like getting comfortable on a ski, getting comfortable on a board, and that like entry level, you know, sort of couple of years of like where you're just trying to balance on a surf ski and you're like, I am never going to be able to paddle this surf ski. It takes like 2 years of doing it before it's like you can even paddle it and like start to get better at it. Like you have to get over that hurdle, but also like bring a friend with you on that journey, because it makes it so much more fun to have somebody else that like you are also struggling with and learning with and competing against. Like that's the best part of the sport, is like the friends that I've made in it and that you're racing with and competing with. So like, don't do it alone, like drag somebody along with you on this journey. It'll make it way better.
Awesome. And final question, what's the meaning of life according to April Gorman?
Oh, the meaning of life. I'd say just being with your community, like whatever that looks like. And for me, that's a lot of stoked people that want to just get like bashed around in the ocean a lot. But yeah, whatever your community is, just be with them. I think that that's usually when I'm the happiest. So meaning of life. Yeah, be with your people.
That's a great one. And in 54 episodes, we've not had that one yet. So thank you so much. April, thank you really so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure. You've spoken about so many things that are dear to my heart, and I know the people listening out there. And
thanks for having me, Sean. We
wish you the best of luck, and we can't wait to follow your journey. How can we follow you? Could you give your Instagram a shout out?
Yeah. It's April Anui Nui Joy, which is my name. It's April A-N-U-E-N-U-E Joy. That's my personal one. Also our team one, US Lifesaving Sport. We'll be having a lot on there next week for Worlds. So yeah, those are the two easiest, I would say.
Epic. Well, we'll be following along, and thank you for listening. This has been episode 54 with April O'Gorman. April, thank you again.
Thanks, Sean. I'll speak to you soon.
Peace. April, thank you.
Yeah.
So sick. Yeah, crushed it.
Thanks. It was a fun combo for sure.
Yeah, you totally brought it all together and really accomplished the goal I had, was really stoking people out. And I know they're going to be stoked, because every guard I talk to now, it's like, oh, it's August. What are we going to do now? It's like the dream's over. And it's like, dude,
you
can continue this dream. And, and that's what you're a living product of that. So great work.
Thanks. Yeah. It is really funny to me that everyone does. It's like the September blues that everyone
and you can smell it in the air. It's like the earth just tilted a little bit. Like you're getting that warmth and we're getting that cold, and it's coming to an end.
Yeah, but yeah, they can still keep doing it. I mean, we're literally winter here doing irons in like full leggings and tops and everything. And so, yeah, it doesn't need to. It's just so funny to me in the US, it does.